Hello, men, and welcome to another podcast, this one for the 4th of May. Hard to believe that we're already into the month of May. Today we're continuing in our series, Spiritual Coaching. I believe this is now the 9th week in that series. Last week we looked at the topic of work, and our big idea for last week was that we were created to be givers and receivers, and yet the fall has corrupted that initial understanding and our initial purpose so that we now often become producers and then takers, and that we use the output of our hands, the output of our minds, not to bless people only, but sometimes we use it to manipulate people and make them feel obligated to help us get what we want. So instead of willingly giving and then willingly receiving, we tend more toward just producing things and then helping ourselves or trying to manipulate people into getting from them what we want. Well, today we're going to continue in the second phase of spiritual coaching. How does a man respond to the things that intersect his everyday life? Today's topic is a man and his marriage. And we're going to use that theme of being givers and receivers, and we're going to carry that forward into the discussion on marriage. And I think that even for those of you who have been married for a number of years and would consider yourselves to be in very good marriages, there may be at least a couple of things that you can benefit from by listening along with us this morning. As always, I hope this is a blessing, and we'll catch up with you again next week. This morning I'm going to just do a little bit of quick reminder, bring us up to speed, kind of like refresh our memories and refocus us on why we're here and why we're talking about what we're talking about this morning. And then I'm going to ask Scott Baker to come up, and he's going to share a couple of things, something that he's given to me and I actually passed out to you last week. Fortunately, he's brought another substantial collection of handouts along. I'll let him pass them out. So anyway, as I said last week, we're into what I'll call the second phase of this coaching series. The first was a collection of tools that I wanted to give everyone to help each person understand, A, how to care for yourself spiritually, and then how to teach others to care for themselves spiritually. So we looked at those four big building blocks. I have to commit to invest. I have to have a plan for that investment. And then I begin a process of discovery. Who I am. What God's called me to be. Where I stand today versus God's aspirations for me. What are some of the things in me that I would like to change? And how do I go about changing that? So there's this whole continual process of discovering both who I am and who God's called me to be. And then there's the day-to-day, week-to-week practice of what I'm discovering, which over a period of time reforms who I am into the new man that I aspire to be. So invest, discover, practice. We consolidated that into a three-step plan that we say we go through all the time. We learn, which means we gather in new information. We understand, which means we mix our present experience with that and come to a full comprehension of what we've learned. And then day by day, again, we practice. Because it's really in the practice that we come to understand the truth. A good example, and we're going to look at that today, is marriage. When we go into marriage, we have a whole collection of what we think our understandings about marriage is, and then we begin to practice marriage and we find out what it really is. And in a lot of cases, we discover that our pre-marriage knowledge isn't really quite in line with our real-world experiences. So as we practice something, we gain new understandings. So before we get into today's topic, which is marriage, in that second phase, I guess I should talk about the second phase. So the second phase then is, what are the big building blocks in a man's life? What are those areas where his spiritual life is going to intersect with reality? Anybody remember the components of a spiritual life? What is my spiritual life? Somebody besides Brian who has eloquently described that already. The components of my spiritual life. I'm an inner man. Go ahead. That's a good start off. Somebody besides Jim, because Jim could fill it in, I'm sure. Go ahead. Responds to, relates to. Everything in his life is a good way to describe it, but then we break it down more specifically. How my inner man responds to and relates to himself, to God, to every other human being on the planet, and to the created world. So last week we talked about work. There was one key phrase that I hope everyone took away from the concept of work. And it was sort of like God's original intention for work. Does anybody remember what that was? It says that we were originally created to be two things when it comes to work. It is always refreshing to know what a powerful impact I have on you men. Well, I heard it somewhere. Yes, we were intended to be givers and receivers. Are you looking at something that you... You weren't even here last week.
I can read it,
though. Okay. Then we were intended to be givers and receivers, but what's happened? That today we don't look at work as a process of being ongoing givers and then vessels into which other people can pour their giving, but what have we become instead? Very often we become producers and takers. In our producing, we feel obligates others to give something back to us. So instead of freely giving and freely receiving, we end up intentionally producing so that we can extract. Very different focus. All right, so Scott, I'm just going to leave this right here so that we get you recorded in the whole thing. We want that to be a part of the experience for the morning. So.
Thank you. All right. Last week, Glenn handed out this little handout on coach's resolution. I added a few things with that packet. You can or cannot put it in your binder. It's up to you what you want to do with it. But basically, the concept came from a coach at Lehigh University. My wife has worked at Lehigh in the athletic department for 32 years now. We know all the coaches, all the athletes, all the parents. So it's really a close family environment at Lehigh when we look at sports. But beyond sports, there's education and there's real life lessons that the coaches teach the students. And I thought this was really interesting when I read this coach's resolution. Because it really parallels what we do here at Morningstar and what Glenn's been doing over the last several weeks and several years as far as developing coaches and spiritual leaders. So, first thing I want to talk about when you look at this, hopefully everybody had a chance to read it last week, is resolution. When we talk about resolution, you know, some people may or may not know what resolution really is, but last week we talked about identity and work from a man's perspective and from a spiritual perspective, and this week Glenn's going to talk about men and marriage. And when I kind of thought about this coach's resolution, both of those really are overlapping in this. But to help out a little bit, I looked up what resolution meant in Webster's dictionary, and it really means a firm determination, an act of resolving or doing something, a course of action determined or decided on. And there's several others in here that you can read, but basically a resolution is a deliberate action with intent. And when you look at these resolutions, that's exactly what it is. It's a deliberate action with intent. So take a look with me at the first one here. I resolve to live under the authority of Jesus, the master coach, and his word. So considering Jesus our master coach in life, he's setting the guidelines. He's teaching us how to become better men, better leaders, both in church and in our workplace and at home. If you look at Matthew 22:37, Jesus replied, "Love the Lord with your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." The next one, I resolve that I will honor the master coach by loving my wife and my family above all else, including my coaching. So putting God and your family, your wife, first really is going to set the stage for how you act as a man, what you do, and what you decide to, you know, display yourself as. Looking at Ephesians 5, 25 through 27, and, you know, looking at that resolve, it states, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, to make her holy, cleansing her with washing, by washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless." I don't know, sometimes upholding that one might be a little difficult, but as we grow spiritually, that might become a little easier for us. And I think that has a lot to do with maybe some of the things Glenn will talk about later today. The next one, I resolve that my love for a team member or the team will not be dependent on how either performs, duplicating the master coach and his love for me. And if you look at Romans 5:8, it says, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we are still sinners, Christ died for us." So it doesn't really matter how we perform. God's love and forgiveness goes beyond our actions at the time. The next one, I resolve to serve those I coach in order that I might be found a faithful steward while showing them a true picture of the greatness found in the master coach. And 1 Corinthians 4:2 says, "Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful." The next one, I resolve to honor the master coach by giving my very best as a coach, that he may be pleased with me, a follower of all he teaches. That kind of parallels with what we talked about last week in working. You know, we want to work to please God. And if you look at Colossians 3, 23 through 24, it says, "Whatever you do, work with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving." And then the final one, I resolve to be a coach who intentionally coaches with the goal of duplicating others who will look like the master coach. And in 2 Timothy 2:2 it says, "And the things you have heard me say in the presence of many witnesses, entrust to reliable people who will also be qualified to teach others." And I thought this was really important from a coach's perspective, that he wants to lead his other coaches in his staff, his players, the team, the university, and other students that are watching the sporting event. He uses this as a map, a guideline, a footprint for his teachings. And on the back copy, I attached a little biography of Brett Reed, the coach at Lehigh, as to what he's been able to accomplish in a short period of time in his position. And in that, he always follows this format for coach's resolution. And it's amazing when you think about, when we look at the Word of God and we think about what we do at our workplace and what we do at our homes, if we really follow what's in this book, it works. And good things come out of it. And I just want you to think about something for a minute here. Think to yourself, and this is what I'd like you to do. This is what I did, and it seemed to help me out a little bit. Think to yourself, pray for insight, and listen to what God is telling you regarding this next question. When considering yourself as spiritually immature or as a spiritual leader, how would you complete the following sentence? "I resolve." Now, you don't have to answer that. It's a rhetorical thing. It's something for you to just think about internally. But read this when you get a chance, and see if some of these things apply to what you've been doing, or maybe we need to work a little bit harder on doing in the future. And I know that I always like a good challenge, and I've seen other men that respond to challenges. So I want to challenge you with the last bullet that I have on this. Be bold, step out of your fears, and take the next step of becoming a spiritual leader with yourself, your family, your friends, and others that you meet. Remember that God is with you every step of the way. That's all I've got for you.
All right, so a few reasons why I asked Scott to do this. First, it's possible for every one of us to be this guy. I want you to believe that. How many of you have started to overcome that hurdle, the I can do this in another man's life hurdle? Are more of you reasonably confident that you would be able to do that, to invest significantly, that you have something to offer? How many of you even believe you have something to offer to another man? And then beyond believing you have something to offer, do you think this is helping you to acquire some skills that will make it believable for you to offer it? So it's one thing to have stuff locked up inside of you, bottled up inside of you, and think you'd like to offer it to somebody. It's another thing to have the unique set of skills or understandings that will help you to unbottle that, as it were. Last week, and this is going to tie in nicely with what Scott left us with, last week I gave you a homework assignment. It was to read a collection of verses, and after that, to maybe draft a statement of purpose for yourself. A statement of what your work is, what your life is about. Did anybody take that seriously enough to actually do that? I see. Does anyone even remember that I gave that assignment out last week? Okay. Two people remember? Three people remember? Oh, now there's more hands going up. Okay.
Did you give that in the beginning of class or at the end?
No, you were not here when I gave that out. So you are exempt from this.
I did.
Take that with you again this week.
And next week we're going to ask you to read it.
Or let me be more specific. Let's say you weren't here last week. Or let's say you were too busy this week and you didn't have the time to do it. Let's just say. If I were to walk up to any one of you and not put you on the spot in a group setting, but one-on-one, could you, in a concise statement or two, tell me who you are and what you're about?
Be ready in every season.
Think about that. How many of you, going throughout your day, sometimes wonder why you do what you do? How many of you ever question, what's this all about? Why am I doing this? How did I get here? How in the world did I get here? I started out in life here, and here I am here 20 years later, and this is not at all what I hoped I would be or where I would be. Has that thought ever randomly flashed through your mind? The reason it does, in many cases, is because we didn't have a memorable mission statement. This is who I am. This is who I am in all seasons. This is who I am at all times. And therefore, and here's why this is important. You will have more offers and more opportunities to do things than you are either capable or qualified or have time to do. Have you ever found yourself sucked into something because it seemed like a good idea to do it at the time? It seemed like the right thing to do, but it wasn't really, in reflection, afterwards, the right opportunity for you. Anyone ever had that? If you don't know who you are, and if you are not progressively coming into a more complete understanding of who you are, how will you know what is the right opportunity for you, what is God's opportunity for you, versus what is just another opportunity for you? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when you're 20 or 25, it can be excusable for you to jump on any opportunity. After all, opportunities may seem rare. But if you're at all good at something, by the time you are 40 or 45, people are going to bring volumes of things for you to do. They're going to want to try to dump things on you. And anybody that displays any kind of leadership capability, anybody actually that displays any kind of consistent followership ability, they'll have more opportunities given to them than they can handle or that they want. So here's the question. How do I decide which ones to take when and where? Now we're going to move this into the topic for the morning, which is marriage. And I know I said this on multiple occasions, that this is probably a topic that I would never wade into, and you need to stop your snickering right now.
He's an expert. Why isn't it fun?
So, right. Well, honestly, I've had some...
You learn from mistakes.
Thanks. Do you want to get up here next?
I'm just saying.
I can tell you I'm a pro at it.
Yeah. You do something wrong, you don't have to do it again.
Right.
She learned from mistakes.
We're going to talk about that this morning, too. The reason I introduced that right after that, what will you do, I guess, is this key question. How far up on your list of priorities and responsibilities is your marriage? Are there opportunities in life that can encroach on your commitment to your marriage? Do you understand what I'm asking? Are there good, important opportunities that can present themselves, and can they compete with your marriage for attention? And if that's true, then do you understand where in your list of priorities your marriage is now and where it should be? So that's a reflective question. And if you cannot, I suppose, incorporate into your statement of purpose in some way, some word or two that reminds you of where your marriage is in that overall collection of priorities, it's possible that it can completely slip from your awareness in the day-to-day comings and goings of your life. All right. As a segue from work, which is giving and receiving, receiving being equally important as giving, something that we don't do well, but something that I think if we could understand that we were put here intentionally to be both givers and receivers, it would make work more rewarding, and it would most assuredly make marriage more sensible. And that's why there's a really big connection here between work and marriage, because I believe that God's intention is that part of our overall big picture of work is to be givers and receivers in a primary relationship. Top of page 23, I want to talk about something that at first is going to seem like it has very little bearing on marriage. Laziness is the enemy of many things that I should do. Laziness is also the enemy of many things that I could do. But laziness is not the proper explanation for every inaction in my life. So have you ever just written something in your life off to you're just lazy or you're not that? How would you describe laziness? Before you look at what I put down there. Okay, everybody's looking down at their paper. So that they can regurgitate my definition later.
Well, I got a couple of people's faces coming to mind.
One of the things that sits right next to laziness for me is apathy. Kind of thing. Like apathy and procrastination. In my literature, it says apathy and procrastination are two of our inherent enemies. The heck with it, I'll do it tomorrow. You can live that way your whole life, and tomorrow never comes.
I love those words. Actually, I love those words.
And for me, that's how laziness happens to me, is I get caught up in, you know what, I'll do it tomorrow, or, you know. And every man's got a house half done, at least at some point in his life, because of those two words.
Laziness, as a taking a minute to think about it. The thing that bothers me about laziness is
is it's a pattern of behavior. You know, the guy whose laziness bothers me is the guy who's not interested in seeing that there's a better way to do it than what he's doing. He's purposely doing it the stupid way so that I'll do it, or walking a little slower so that I get to whatever needs picking up first. You know, I'm thinking about in work. It's a purposeful thing. Laziness isn't stupid or it isn't slow.
Yeah.
It's an intentional laying back so someone else picks it up.
It's not idle.
Riding coattails.
Yes.
Okay.
The first two words that you want to just want to do is I think of fear and I think of selfishness. Either I choose not to do something because I'm afraid to do it, or afraid to do it wrong, afraid it might take longer than I want, afraid it might not do it right, or I just don't want to do it because there's something else that I'd rather do, something else that's got my attention.
Some amusement.
Okay. Can you, let me interject something before we move ahead with the discussion. Can you see how if you don't have a defined and clear purpose for your life, it would be tough to distinguish when you were being lazy versus when you were being selective? In other words, if you don't know what you should do and what you shouldn't do, how will you know how much you should invest in what you should never have done to begin with? Think about that. Have you ever been...
Who's on first?
No, this is the... Have you ever invested too much time in the wrong thing and it's then deprived you of the time that you needed to do the right thing, and you get caught in what you think is a cycle of you're downing yourself and I'm lazy and I should invest more time in this? So we've shared a number of ideas. Can we bring this together now?
You said it. So throwing good money after bad.
What's that?
In investment terms, they call that throwing good money after bad. You've already invested in that, and it's losing money. Stop throwing money at that. Pull out of it. Take your things and invest in something that will produce.
Well, if I don't understand what my purpose is, though, I can be ridden with guilt because I'm not investing a sufficient amount of time in something that I should never have invested in to begin with. Let me ask you another complimentary question. Have you ever chosen to invest in one thing because it was easy rather than invest in something else because it was hard?
Or invest in something that I wanted to instead of what I needed to.
And now, do you see why these are relationship questions as much as work questions? Because when I talk about laziness, what comes to mind first? I think it's what Brian talked about. Brian talked about someone or some situation in the workplace, and we always associate laziness with work. But if our relationships are part of the work that we are called to, is it possible that we can be lazy in our relationships? And what does that look like?
Ask my ex-wife, she'll tell you.
What's that?
I said ask my ex-wife, she'll tell you.
Well, one of the things that, and I can say this with resolve, because I've taken the time, and I've done marriage for a few times. It says in the beginning of the book that we read on Sunday that he made for us a suitable helper. Not slave, helper.
Mm-hmm.
I am to do the lion's share of the work everywhere. And if I'm a good leader, I know how to delegate. Hey, honey, I'm not going to get that finished. Can you finish that? Hey, honey, I might not be able to get this accomplished. So you mind doing that? That's, for me, what that looks like. But I think all too often, I take advantage of the situation because, oh, I work until 7 o'clock. She's got 2 more hours than I do. She should. And then...
Can I ask you to hold that thought right there? Jim made a statement that many men, myself included at times, find objectionable. How many of you have ever caught yourself keeping score in a relationship? I've had this conversation several times in the last week. I've done... And she's only done shh. Therefore, she's behind. Honey, you need to pick up the pace a little bit. You see where I am? You see where you are?
Yeah, it doesn't turn out.
It's not going to turn out. Don't say that out loud. That's not something you say out loud. You have that conversation with an accountability partner. You have that conversation with anybody except for what?
You're dead.
But within the past 2 weeks, I have had that conversation specifically with no less than half a dozen men. All about marriage. I'd like you to turn over to principle number 7, which is on page 25 for a moment.
Wow, we tell our premarital couples a lot of things, but I think a couple small things. The word compromise in a marriage is a word for success. Other parts of our life, integrity and morals and values, that's not a good word. But in marriage, compromise is a word for success. And also, it's not 50-50, it's 100%, 100%. This is the only thing. We're talking about work, it takes work.
Remember what Jim said, that we can start to think that the wife needs to pick up the pace, but in fact, God has provided for us a helper suitable for our needs in order for us to fulfill the things that God has called us to do. And then you said, but it's up to us to do the lion's share. And we're uncomfortable with that. Principle number 7 is marriage is not really something you have or own, but something which you do. You do husbanding toward a wife who has made a promise to do loving and serving toward you as well. There's that giving and receiving. Interestingly, the word husband is associated with, well, what is, stop right there. When you think of the word husband, what's its natural meaning to you? Apart from marriage, what does it mean to husband something?
Animal husbandry.
Also can apply to a vineyard. Right? What does it mean to husband something?
To care for, to take care of.
The word wife is actually derived from German origins and is akin merely to being a woman. In other words, when there is a husband and a wife, the role of husband by name has expectations assigned to it. The word wife doesn't have expectations assigned to it. Now, just think about that for a minute. What is, and how many of us as men go into the relationship with a high level of expectations about what either the marriage is going to do for them or the woman is going to do for them?
Husbands love, wives submit. Totally different word.
Wives respect. Wives respect for these husbands.
Well, this is, why is it like that? That's all part of the fall thinking. Our sinful thinking, incorrect knowledge.
But what if every day we went into it with the assumption, and let's just say for a minute that no matter how much baggage you and I have in our relationships, do you have any baggage in your marriage?
No, of course not.
No matter how many yesterdays there are in your marriage, no matter how many bad starts, false starts, no starts, and no matter how much your wife remembers all that, tomorrow's a fresh slate, if you're willing. And I have to remind myself of this a lot. I think it's helpful if we simply expect that we should place more responsibility on ourselves and less on our wives. We are there to husband, which is to care for, to nurture, to bring out the best in. And when I lose sight of that, and I start to look at my marriage as something that should fulfill me, make me happy, take care of all the things in my life that perhaps I don't get around to taking care of, then I set myself up for disappointment, but that's only the beginning of it. What else do I do as far as my responsibilities in my marriage? I never fulfill my responsibility to my wife in terms of bringing out the best in her, because I'm so focused on getting my needs met in the marriage. I realize that's much easier to say than to do, which is why we return to the laziness concept. I think we can be lazier in relationships than almost anywhere else in life. But it's disguised as something. It's disguised as a lot of things. And I put two excuses that are common here when it comes to laziness, but there are also reasons. Do I lack skills as opposed to... Have you ever had something lingering in the way of a household project? I'm just asking you to imagine. I know this is beyond your imagination, but if you can think about someone else that you know and they've had a household project and it remained undone.
Don't we all have to have one of those husbands?
Don't we all what?
Have to have one of those?
As a husband?
Yeah.
Well, it's not obligatory, but...
I know guys who are great finishers, man. If they can't get it finished, they bring somebody in to get it finished. So they don't want to hear, hey, you know, that's not done yet. That's not done yet. That's not done yet.
Well, coming back to an understanding of who we are. Was it within your capability to do the thing that you started to do to begin with? Is a key question. Have you ever started something and knee deep into it before you discovered that maybe you were not the right man for the task? I can do this. I'm sure I can figure it out along the way.
Can't be that hard.
It can't be that hard. Other people have done it. Surely I can too.
I know how to drive.
What have I gotten myself into?
So there's a difference sometimes between laziness and skilllessness, and sometimes we don't discover the skills we don't have until we're already into something. So sometimes we falsely call ourselves lazy or falsely call ourselves procrastinators when really what we're skirting around is the fact that I don't know the next step to take. I really don't know what to do next. I'm a little bit worried that the next step, here I am in the middle of a household wiring project, we'll say, and I'm using something that's a little funny, but I wonder what's going to happen when I touch wire A to wire B and turn the switch on. I wonder if it's all going to work well or if the house is going to catch fire. Go on.
I mean, do we really call that laziness? I don't see lack of a skill set as laziness. I've never seen that.
But it could appear that.
Laziness is a choice.
Yeah.
You choose to be lazy. Oh, you know what? I'm stuck. I'm calling Tom Dumeyer and say, Tom, look, I got wires sticking out of a wall. I don't know what I did.
But that is that is a commitment to follow through and get it done and realizing that you're at the end of yourself and you need to do something.
I think laziness is an intentional action.
Okay.
That's all it is. I mean, to be lazy, you have to intentionally want to not do so.
All right. What I'm hoping that we're all going to derive at the end of this discussion is a very clear set of understandings that we can take into relationships. I'm not talking about work. I'm using work to help us see something that we can understand more easily in work than we can in relationships. When am I lazy in a relationship versus when do I lack the skills to excel in that relationship? And if I lack the skills, is that fixable? Can I learn for tomorrow what I don't understand how to do today? There's a note here that I wrote, and I'm not sure which of the principles it is that I wrote it for. We'll just go to principle number two for a moment. The person that we marry is the product of others. So stop right there and make sure that you understand what I've just said. The woman that you marry is the net output of other people's efforts. A school system, parents, all the other influences in her life. That is the person that you marry. And you are not at fault for who that person is on the day you marry them. Who they are on the inside. You with us, me so far? Over a period of 20 or 30 years, if you are in fact seriously engaged in that relationship, and you are the husband, what's the husband? The nurturer, the provider, the caretaker. If you are that person well, at the end of 30 years of looking across the breakfast table at that person, you can no longer, with integrity, say, you're just messed up because your family's that way.
You know, that's not... I'm sorry, John's talked about that on many a Sunday.
that's not an excuse ever. You're more than 30 years old. You can change, and I'm sure more than one person has said.
I'm not talking about the woman's responsibility to change. I can't force her to change. What I am saying is that sometimes when we're 10 or 20 years into a marriage and we're complaining about our wife, and who hasn't done that? What are we really, honestly complaining?
She's been living with you for 20 or 30 years.
That's the point.
Responsibility.
Yeah, I need to own some responsibility for this, because maybe for 20 or 30 years I have been lazy, or I have lacked the skills necessary, or some way not acquired the resources in order to build her up. I don't want to hear that any more than you do. Okay, I assure you of that. I do not want to hear that any more than you do. Sometimes the person that we are married to after 20 years is our fault.
Amen.
That's all I'm saying. Scott, oh, do you want to beat me up over this? I'm sorry.
I think it's interesting. You talked about work. Years,
yeah.
And work is being given every single day. And marriage is work. And men have to give love. And they want to receive respect. And John did a connection from love and respect. And women, they excel when they're loved. Men excel when they're respected. However, a man's difficult natural tendencies are to give respect because somebody performed. And we are a little negligent on giving love, or intimidated to give love, or sheltered from whatever reasons, to give what is necessary to gain, to receive the respect that we want. And looking at a marriage down the road, thinking, why doesn't she do what I want her to do? It's because for whatever number of years, you weren't loving, you weren't the caretaker, you weren't the giver, and you didn't nourish that part. It's like a plant, you know? You don't give the plant water, the plant dies. You don't give the wife love, well, she's not going to produce respect.
You mean she doesn't die? Darn.
They are resilient. I'll tell you
that. Okay.
Well, the sad thing, well, this is all funny statements, but the sad news is sometimes she does die inside, and the husband doesn't realize it. He said, well, how did this happen all of a sudden? And it's been that way for 5 years. It didn't happen all of a sudden. Where did this come from? And, yeah. He don't kill her.
And along this points to encouragement. We, on both sides, we love to be encouraged. Children love to be encouraged when they do it. How good am I at that? My old man was in the military for 30 years. Encouragement? Encouragement was taught to me, and not by my father. It was taught to me by my sponsor, accountability people. People were going, whoa, 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 whoa. Easy, guy. Ease up. Maybe a little positive affirmation would help. I don't have to wonder why I got two divorces. I don't have to wonder that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. It took me until I was 38 to learn how to say a kind word to another woman. But I had to learn how to do it. And once I grasped the hold of it, and what it did for that person, the blossom, the shine that came out of that person, and I want to do that all the time. I love when she smiles and says, hey, thanks, honey, that's awesome. It makes me feel good.
Let me put you on ice for just a moment. You had your hand up, right? Okay. I want to come back to what you said, because it was powerful, and yet here's where we get hung up. Men want to be respected. Here's something that I tell men a lot. And again, remember I said I had multiple conversations in the past couple weeks about the one thing. I had multiple conversations about this second component too. She doesn't respect me. Respect is typically earned. Men crave respect, and it's the currency that they want. Now hang on to this currency thing, okay? Women crave love. Love is unearned. Remember what you read before? Love is unearned. It's not based on performance. What is respect based on? A certain level, not only of position, but performance. I can't respect someone who consistently performs poorly. My obligation is to love someone whatever. Why? You're just
someone who performed poorly. Maybe he's a skinny weakling, but man, he tries. His heart is in it every time.
Well, if he's lazy.
I don't mean that he's trying. I don't mean that he's giving his heart and it's just not working well. I mean, if someone is lazy, if they are not doing what they're supposed to, if they're doing the exact opposite of what they're supposed to, if they've got 30 years, respect is earned over time, might be the completion of that sentence. Therefore, if I have a 20-year track record of doing things that are not worthy of being respected, I shouldn't be shocked if my wife does not respect me. And I shouldn't be shocked if the day I turn the corner and start to perform differently, that she doesn't start to respect me the day after.
You see, that's part of the problem right there.
Yeah.
That's very important.
Yes.
See, I respect.
What do you mean? It's been 24 hours.
I'm different now.
Yeah. I see the 24 years, but it's been a whole week, okay? That's the truth right there.
We tell people, man, you got two heartbeats clean, and you think everybody should just change.
Well, there you go. So we all understand that. So if I have been sowing seeds of something that aren't worthy of being respected, it's going to take me to a while to undo that thinking. And we can draw out the card, we can play the card, well, in Christ I'm a new creation, and that's true. And Jesus may know that, but your wife doesn't yet. So she needs to see that.
And maybe the best thing is for her to see is, well, now there's a real possibility, now there's a real future, now there's a real foundation for this change to happen. You know, before maybe there was not much hope, but now we can. So it's not immediate, but there's a hope there. There's a real possibility here now. That's what she can see.
And I heard somebody say this the other day. They're talking to their wife, and they're typically, you know, I lead, and some said something kind of off the cuff. And because they're working on stuff, said, you know what? I didn't mean that to sound like that. Like right away. Just right away said, I didn't mean that to sound like that. And I'm like, hey, good job, dude. That's awesome. Because I know she heard that. But he's going through the process of looking at himself and trying to respond instead of react, trying not to be so iron-fisted, and trying not to... Because it is the work of this. It's hard to be humble. I want respect. How do you get respect? Drop the fist. That's how you get respect. Not really. Trust me. Not really. That's fear. That's something else.
All right.
Be careful.
So three quick verses, bottom of page 23. An excellent wife is a crown of her husband, but she who brings shame is like rottenness to his bones. I wouldn't recommend you go home and read the second part of that verse.
I'm really into the word.
Everyone go home and tell your wife that she is rottenness to your bones and see how that goes. Which says?
It is better to live in the corner of
your house. Oh, yes, yes. Yes. Right. Well, and remember, what we marry is somebody else's product. Who we are married to after a period of time is at least partly our own product. Whoever finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Do you honestly believe that? And then again, right in keeping with the same thing, houses and wealth are inherited from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. Now, here's the thing. Remember Ben Franklin's wise saying, marry in haste, repent in leisure? Anybody heard that before?
Say it again.
Marry in haste, repent in leisure. You understand what that says? Sometimes we marry the woman that we wanted, not the woman that God wanted for us, perhaps. I'm saying that at times that has happened, where we go off half-cocked and we go ahead and get what we think we want. We know what's best for us. Sometimes not. So if you're not married yet, let's you know, take the time necessary. But if you are married, then it's the good gift God has given you. And if you don't feel it's the good gift that God has given you, then you're going to need to do some legwork in order to turn it into a good gift. Just saying. All right, so what I'd like to do is, principle number one, we get married with expectations, we remain married through character development. So marriage is not only going to give you the chance to see who it is you said I do to, marriage also gives you an opportunity to see who you are and what your skills and abilities and resources are in the inside. So here's a question for you to think about first. What has your marriage revealed to you recently about what you need to learn or where you need to grow? Just take a moment to think about that. You know, Brian, I forgot to come back to you 5 minutes ago.
That's all right. I would have derailed everything.
So think about some of the expectations that you went into marriage with. Versus now you're X number of years into a marriage. Do you go into marriage with the expectation that you were going to be a giver and a receiver in that marriage, or was it primarily about being a receiver? And I say that marriage is simply an extension of work because it is sort of an ideal union where both my need to give, remember I've been built and designed to give, my need to give and my need to receive are both found in one relationship. So just take a moment to absorb that. It is a unique relationship, uniquely suited for me to express both my need to give, according to who I am and how I am, and my need to receive. And that can fall through physical, emotional, mental, your creativity, all of that. And it's why we come back to that laziness idea. How many times are you lazy and fail to give your absolute best creatively, expressively in that relationship? Again, a couple of conversations with men within the past month. And I'm going to paraphrase here. It's not word for word, but, well, I bring home a paycheck. What more does she want? And I realize the guy's really sincere and he's doing a lot of work to bring a paycheck home. He is. And he's highly invested in that. And I will guarantee you he's extremely creative, or they are. They're creative, they're energetic, they're passionate about what they do, they love what they do, and they take all that passion, they pour it into their work, they give a substantial income to their wife, and their shock is, it's not enough. What's up with that?
But where is the problem? Is it with the husband or the wife?
Bring me more of that question.
The problem is clearly his.
Well, sure.
He is not, you know, dying to himself every day. There's a real lack of humility. And if there's anything I'd like to say about what we've been talking about, when we talk about laziness, we're making a judgment and not a nice one. And we need to be real careful about, you know, at work, thinking about someone else being lazy, all we can really do is what we do. You know, we can't sit there and say, you know, Glenn doesn't do as much at work as I do.
Oh, I'm saying laziness is something that we need to own ourselves relationally. That I'm not saying that we point the finger at some. I can't fix them even if they are lazy. Even if I did make that judgment about you, Scott, I don't have it within me to fix that. You have to want to fix that for yourself. My suspicion is that every one of us sitting here is relationally lazy in areas and knows it. But we don't look at relationship and laziness. I haven't forgotten you. Go ahead.
You made a point that somebody approached you about, I bring a paycheck home, what more?
You feel bad to say that.
No, just yesterday, I was in a conversation, and it pertained to children. And, you know, they're a product of two people and the environment they grew up in. And in that environment, work. Work to get a paycheck, work to get more money, work to give the kids more, work so that they can get to college, work. And what the conversation was have that person invested the same amount of time in their children with time, spending time with them, nurturing them, teaching them, as they did at work to earn a dollar. Do you think that child would have the same problems? I thought that was really interesting that, you know, and you're going back to, hey, look, I bring home a paycheck for a while. Well, it's not about the paycheck. It's about the time and investing in others. And I it really kind of struck a chord because I felt trapped in that myself. You know, what I thought was the right course of action, I got to the end of the road, found there was nothing there. And I should have taken that other fork in the road, you know, and spent the time with the family, spent the time with my son and my daughter, spend the time with my wife. Maybe things would be differently at this end of the road as it was the other direction. So,
okay, I want to, at this, right now, before we go any further, I want to distinguish between two big ideas. Guilt is one, and conviction is the other. Guilt can make us beat ourselves up. It can make us hate ourselves for who we were in the past. It can bog us down in a mire of regret that we can't pull ourselves out of. Good, positive conviction says, yesterday I didn't know any better. Yesterday I didn't understand that. Today I do. So from this moment on, I want to, I will start to, I will try to live in a different direction. Guilt is, generally speaking, not helpful. Affirming conviction is, and I don't want to get stuck in guilt. So don't leave here feeling bad about what you didn't know yesterday or didn't do yesterday. Remember what we said, we get married with expectations, but a very low set of skill levels about doing marriage. You've got to believe that. You were not born with what is necessary in order to be a good husband. You have to learn it along the way. So day one of marriage, you knew very little about it, and so did your wife. And that's another important component. Your wife didn't know anything more about how to be married to you than you did about how to be married to her. Here's a sad reality of the time in which we live. A progressively greater percentage of the population has had a good example in the home for how to do this. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, women, your wife may be among them, did not grow up, I don't know, I have no idea, did not grow up in a home where being a good wife was something that she saw lived out. The home is probably the greatest training school for how to do marriage. If the home that either of you grew up in was somewhat confused, we'll say, then it wasn't a really good training ground. And you'll have a little bit more work to do as an adult. But no matter what home you grew up in, it still didn't equip you with everything that you need. Any thoughts before we move on? All right. Principle number three, men and women, while being designed to complement and complete each other, have been drawn into competition and conflict with each other. How many of you have ever, whether outwardly or just thought it to yourself, the marriage would be a lot better if she was a little bit more like you? If she was a little bit more responsible, if she was a little bit more hardworking, if she was a little bit more whatever, if she was a little bit more easygoing. And you got to come back to this if you really believe that these principles in Proverbs are true. A prudent wife is from the Lord. Whoever finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Sometimes the things about your wife that frustrate you that are different are the very things that you need in your life. You're confused, Scott. You've had none of this experience in your life. Well, sometimes it's what it takes to complete you. Here is another thought. If God had a purpose and a plan for your life, let's just imagine that He did for a moment. If God had a purpose and a plan for your life, and you were not complete for that purpose, is it possible that one of the good gifts that God would give you in order to complete your purpose and the plan that He has for you in your life is the wife who would help to fill in some of the blanks in your life? The wife that could help you to fulfill the call. I don't mean do your work for you. I mean help you on the inside to become the person that you need to be.
Like Jerry
Maguire. That's... This is going to probably shock some of you, but I had a few relational rough edges earlier on in my life. See, even John is surprised by that. Yes, yesterday. It was just... Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Principle number four relates to, I'm going to call it security in marriage. Are both you and your wife, but since you can't control your wife's responses to you totally, is your wife secure in the marriage? Does she really understand that you wholeheartedly are committed to marriage for life and therefore she doesn't have to worry about performing today to keep the marriage alive?
That's your big concern. If you're committed, you're going to be there. That's what we were researching.
And we sometimes think that this idea, and we're just going to turn over to Matthew 19. Let's get at least a little bit of scripture in us for the day. I'm going to start at the third verse. And the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" So what does that question right there tell you?
Divorce is okay. People are questioning it all the time anyway.
Well, people were questioning it. Is this okay? It's not something like this is a modern issue. Like in the last 100 years, we've discovered that it's occasionally appealing to ditch your wife. Right, this is a 2,000-year-old text, give or take, and there's the same question. He answered, "Have you not read that He who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.'" So without even reading any further, what do you think his answer is going to be based on what he has said so far, and what are your clues? Nope, what? Well, what does hold fast mean? Change the perspective. What is their question?
What legitimacy? What makes...
Can I find any reason that I can ditch this babe and move on to the next one? Okay, they didn't say it quite like that.
Pretty close.
Well, in the Old Testament, they were finding, and they could have, any reason they wanted to discard their wife.
Deuteronomy 24, 1-4.
See, he's read that.
Therefore a man shall leave...
Search the scriptures diligently.
Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother... and hold fast to his wife. How does Jesus twist that around? What's their question? What are the loopholes that will allow me to get rid of this woman?
Yes.
What is his response?
Focusing on holding it together.
Not only holding it together, but why would you not consider this a treasured gift that you want to hold fast to? Look at that word, hold fast. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what they're asking. How can I find a way to get rid of her? And Jesus is saying, why wouldn't you want to keep her?
Yeah, this is looking at this a whole different way. That's what he said. Turns it around.
So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let man not separate. And they said to him, why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away? And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart. Moses allowed you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. So we'll stop right there. How far along in the process of the two becoming one are you? Let's assume that it takes from the day you marry to the day that one of you dies to complete that process, and it's still not really complete that day. Because you're both changing the whole time. That's an interesting thing. You're both changing. If you could take a snapshot of both of you, maybe you could possibly have the two of you become one at a static moment in time. But you're changing, she's changing, and so the two becoming one is a constant process. Is it an enjoyable process? Or a beleaguering and frustrating, annoying and aggravating process?
That's both.
It can be both. At times. Just remember, you're on recorder here too. And the disciples said to him, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry. Now what's our modern day version of that? If this is the case with marriage, then maybe it's better if we just don't get married.
Just live together?
Can I tell you that today that's even a big commitment? Do you understand what I'm saying? Even today, even living together, even sharing an address and moving a few sticks of furniture into the same place together can be seen by a lot of people as a big commitment. There's a lot of statistics that say that the divorce rate has leveled off, maybe even dropped a little bit. And people point to that and they say, look, it's not that bad. But the reality is that the marriage rate has also dropped off. And so, in fact, marriage is every bit as much in trouble, if not more in trouble, than it has ever been. It's just that fewer people opt even to get married to begin with. So we haven't fixed the problem.
And the people living together, they live together, then they don't live together, and they move on with that one, and move on. So it's not like
there's divorce in that, too.
What?
There's divorce in that, too.
So to speak, yes.
Same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lack of commitment to go beyond that point to become one in marriage.
Right.
So what are we, you know, young people today, are they as committed as people 40 years ago, 50 years ago?
Social pressure.
Oh, they got Facebook now. That's right.
Well, yeah. No, it was, you know, 40 years ago, the girl got pregnant, the guy wanted to marry. Now it's a single mother.
Real sense of commitment to be married.
Social pressure made it. That was the form that things went into. Now it's the single mother is a common occurrence.
Well, if you look at it this day,
strong,
at this day in time, right, pre-birth control of any kind, the likelihood that a woman was going to find herself pregnant sooner or later was almost an inevitability. And apart from the security of a marriage, how was she going to care for herself? How were her kids going to be cared for? They weren't. They were going to become part of the widows and the orphans and didn't even get to be a widow, that needed to be cared for by society. All right. So Jesus never once, this is really interesting. So the disciples are questioning this. Not once is the question of sexuality ever brought out in a way that, for most of us, this is an issue. He says, there's a few cases. Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth. There are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men. And there are eunuchs.
Those are options.
Finally, there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it. All right, now I'm not trying to be negative. I'm not trying to bash any particular situation. But we can see where there's a whole class of people within a certain realm of the Christian faith that have had unicism, if you want to call it that, imposed on them for the sake of following Christ, and it hasn't worked real well. That their desire for sexual expression finds vent somewhere else in less positive ways. And then in turn, by pretending that that's not real, what's the harm that they've brought to the reputation of the church? Think about that. We've invented a rule that says that if you're going to be a follower of Christ in this way, that you will be celibate for the rest of your life. They find that an impossible chore, and in the end, what do? They make victims of people. Just a side note there, that we should not deny how powerful this is. All right, so we'll move on to principle number 5, which has to do with conflict. Disagree respectfully.
You know, I was just thinking, and I don't want to digress here, but in the marriage thing, you know, the whole thing, and you bring in scripture where it says, as much as it depends on you, live at peace with all people.
Right.
So when it comes to a relationship, you can do your 100%, 100%, 100%, but you can't make someone stay married to you.
No, you can't.
So this is where we don't have to live with guilt and condemnation if you're not married any longer and you experience a divorce, you know, and you know that. That was not your intent, that's not your desire, but this is happening. You know, that's where that comes into play there. You can't make something.
And it's good you said that. And if we go back this 2,000 years and we talk about support, for the most part, a woman would have been at a significant disadvantage to care for herself, and therefore her tendency would have been not to walk out of a relationship simply because she needed the support.
It's different today.
It is different today. And because it's different today and it's easier for a woman to walk out of the relationship...
They do.
Well, they do. But then the question is, are they walking out of it because of their character flaws, or are they walking out of it because of yours? And that's a tough one to think about.
Yeah. No, it's pretty much because of mine.
What's that?
It wasn't because of her. She doesn't have it.
All right. Principles of conflict. Disagree respectfully. That by itself is hard. If you come out of a background where a good fight is just entertainment for a Saturday night.
That's one of the sessions we cover. It's called You Know How to Fight a Good Fight. It really is a good session because two imperfect people living together, even though you're Christians and we have expectations, if we're Christians and we're married, we're not going to have a misunderstanding, a disagreement, not a physical altercation, but... You know how to do that constructively, not destructively. We've learned in that over the years just by doing that ourselves. But we all don't know how to do that very well.
No, well, at one point or another in 20 years of marriage, you have had a bad argument.
Oh, yeah.
And I say an argument versus a fight, and that's one of the points that actually I should address right now. Fights have a winner and a loser. So just think about that. You don't want to have a fight. Because a fight has a winner and a loser, and who in the world wants to be the loser?
Well, if you win, you're really...
Yeah, you didn't win anyway.
Yeah, you didn't win.
Argue for the purpose of gaining new information. Sometimes passion is the only way that people have the courage. Anger is actually the only way that people have enough courage to say things that they wouldn't say any other way. Just think about that. Have you ever had to be pushed to the brink of anger before you could express something that had been going on inside and brewing inside of you for a long, long time? And the ideas that needed to be expressed were not necessarily bad or wrong. They might have been very helpful, but the way that you ended up expressing them defeated the whole purpose of the expression.
Charles Stanley did a thing on conflict. His first point was, or his first recommendation was that ask the Holy Spirit, what's the real source of this conflict? Like you're saying, as you're in the fight, you might be focusing on winning and not looking at what's really happening here. Sometimes she'll be saying something to you. It's not about the lawn. You know, like, what's really going on here? Is an important question. You can easily get lost, and then the fight becomes a point in itself.
Yeah.
So here, okay, remember, we can't fix the other side. We can only address our own part of the responsibility. Are you able to be a good and understanding listener to your wife so that she feels at ease discussing what's really bothering her versus picking a fight over the things that really aren't bothering you? And what I mean by that is, have you ever had an issue with someone and it was a big issue, but they didn't seem to want to deal with it, so you found 30 other things that were lesser things that you could nitpick about to the person about, because that would give you a chance to lob little grenades because you really never felt that you could discuss the thing that needed to be discussed. Anybody understand what I'm talking about? Can't talk about the big thing, but I can find 30 little things about you that annoy the heck out of me, and you're going to hear about it all day long. Scott, you had your hand up.
A lot of times when you think about conflict, you think negative. You know, it's bad, it's going to be painful. Actually, conflict is a positive, because having disagreements, having conflict, will lead to some kind of dialogue, which is going to lead to understanding. It might take a while, the process might be longer than you want, but conflict is really good in the end.
It could be. It can be.
It's
addressed the right way.
To speak to that in a different way, if the goal is for the two to become one, and there's no way that the two of you are one when you get married because you're two separate individuals, conflict is at least in part is a way of discovering where the two of you are not one.
See, that's the myth.
What?
We think we get married, oh, now we're one. It's the becoming one. Those people, that's the myth. Everybody thinks that's why marriages are the way they are. They don't realize it's the process, and this is part of the process.
Now you're supposed to think like me because we're married.
Yeah.
You're supposed to just do this thing because we're married.
That's the myth.
Yeah.
And the reality, the two of you will never think the same. You were not intended to be the same. You were intended to complement each other.
That's it. Not complete, but complement. That's it.
All right. Principle number 6, and I think this is a big one, that because a lot of couples don't get this right, it really takes the purpose out of the marriage beyond a certain point. Continue to set new and large goals together. So think about this. Pre-marriage, what's your goal as a couple? To get married. And then what? Don't even look at the notes. Just come on, you can all do this. What's
happily ever after?
Okay, we'll break it down into components. Okay, so to get married, what's the next? Another big goal? Buy a house. That's another very big goal that a lot of couples have. What else? Have kids.
It's usually the woman's goal first. Let's be honest. We love kids. I can't imagine life without kids. But it's the woman usually that says, "Kids, let's bring the kids."
I'm glad you said that, because I'm always curious about that. If I was the only one who really wasn't anxious to have kids, but
I thought we would have kids out at this point. She was ready for kids early.
I have a question. When you hear the wife say, "Your kids are the most important thing in my life," what do you do?
That's.
Some of this has been going on.
You hear it in society.
Oh, you hear a lot of that in society. Now, in the end, you harm the kids and the marriage by doing that.
Yeah, because the kids are going to grow up and leave home, hopefully someday, and then it's going to be you and your wife together, and that better be the main thing.
Well, and not only that, but you do harm to the kids that way, because when kids grow up with the whole thought that they are the center of somebody's world, what happens when one day they're not?
No, they're selfish people out there.
And then they go out, and in their marriage, guess who needs to be the most important person in that marriage?
So how do you tell her that she's doing this all wrong?
Yeah. You live it out and you husband it out.
There you go.
Husbanding, nurturing and caring for.
Yep.
What'd you say? Okay. So you have these two big goals. Let's come back. We're going to get serious here again for a moment. You have these two big goals: to have kids, to buy a house. You've heard me say this before, that most people make only a handful of major decisions in life and then spend years or longer managing the consequences of those decisions. So let's look at the house. You buy a house. What are the consequences of that decision?
Debt.
Okay, debt, which means?
Work.
You got to go to work simply to service the debt. Right? You have already now committed to a certain percentage of your life that will be invested in servicing the debt on that house. I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying that when you make a commitment like this, you have made a long-term commitment to manage it by investing X number of hours of the rest of your life in taking care of that. Not only that, but paying for it isn't enough. Right? It can fall down. You've got to maintain it. You've got to do all those other things.
Happy.
All right, now, kids, you make a decision to have children. All right, now that they're had, right? There's an hour of bliss and then 20 years of misery afterwards, right? Just joking.
Well, you got to teach and train and care for and discipline.
So here is the honest, reflective question in the midst of all that management. And how many of you feel that you're right now in a season of management? You've made a few major decisions some time ago. We want to have a home. We want to have children. We want to have a family together. And now the bulk of your time is spent in managing those couple of decisions that you've made. Would that describe your condition? How many of you are making new significant life goals together? Most couples don't. From the time they make that commitment to have a family together, and aren't the early years of marriage, if you don't fight too much, aren't they kind of fun and challenging and rewarding and there's a lot going on and it's interesting? What happens when the kids leave home and the kids were your last big goal that you had together?
They come back.
Well, okay. With no forwarding address either.
Well, they do. They wreck everything.
If we do not have couple goals together, well, what are the later years goals that couples have?
Well, there's one, and I was thinking when I said
travel.
Right. When I said they come home. Well, if you've made future goals, and then somebody steps in and wrecks your future goals, that can be a real hard on marriage right there. But yeah.
They can't wreck your future goals without your permission, you understand?
Well, at least one of your permission.
Well, okay. We're not...
You've got to be unified on your goals. It's taken these years of cultivation.
So they step
in. You're making an AARP commercial, so you've got to do something.
Okay, so Scott said that travel is a big goal. What else?
Having a nice bar. It could be anything. As long as, like John says, it's a great, you agree on it.
Okay, so here's...
It's doing something together.
Here is my point. Yeah, there you go. Here's my point that I want to try to drive home. In the lives of most people, couples, their early year goals are big and will consume a lot of their time. It prevents them from having the creativity and the energy to consider setting goals now for the future. And when they do get around to setting goals for the future of their relationship beyond kids in the house, it's usually self-amusement goals. They're usually goals about us and pleasing ourselves. The nice home, the nicer car, the different house, the second house, none of which by itself is wrong. But if God has brought us together for a purpose, and if we help each other to complete our purpose, is my purpose all about making me happier? Do you understand what I'm asking? Is it possible that as a couple you might consider setting goals for how together in the future, at a certain point in time, you would be working towards doing these things together as a couple? Serving together, doing something, like John said, doing something together. Not that the second house is necessarily bad, not that the different place to live is necessarily wrong. We're not saying that. But I think the American dream is, I manage to completion some of these early marriage decisions, and then it's all about me from that point on. And then it becomes a constant struggle to make yourself happy again and again. And you can be rewarded in that. There will always be a new invention that comes out that you have to buy. There will always be a new experience that you can have to have so you can spend the rest of your life whiling away your time. So just think about that. It's something for you to think about as a husband. Hey dear, have we set any together goals that are big, that move us out of our comfort and out of our pleasure? All right, principle number 8, life reveals what's already inside of you and waiting to come out. When we see things in a mate that we don't like, we can choose to be shocked and offended or angered. So have you ever discovered something in your wife at a moment of heated discussion that you didn't even know was in there? Have you ever discovered something in your wife at a moment of crisis that you didn't know was in there? Or has she discovered something about you? Now here's the big thing. If pressure reveals what is already in us and gives us maybe the first real honest view of who we really are on the inside, what do we do with that? I can use that to be shocked at who my wife is. I can use that to be offended at who my wife is, really disappointed. Or it can be a way that I can see, here's an area where perhaps in the future I can build into my wife if she's willing, if she'll allow me. If this pressure shows me where she is perhaps weak, that's okay. There's areas where I'm weak. So I can simply be offended and disgusted by that, or I can say, here's an area where I can apply my creativity, where I can start to learn to apply my skills and my abilities, and I can, with her permission, invest into her if she's willing. And I think sometimes we look at who we've married and we say, wow, I'm disappointed at that. Well, I guess I'll just have to live with it. I think this is where we start to find satisfaction in other things. Comes back to that laziness thing that we talked about at the beginning. Sometimes laziness is choosing to go do something somewhere else because it's easier and more rewarding. Have you ever been caught in that trap? And I'm going to put my hand up first and say yes. I've definitely been caught in that trap where it was easier to go do something else that was more rewarding, where my skills were appreciated, where my input was valued. But it was probably the lazy thing to do. All right, principle number 9 and 10, we got to move on with this. Compliments specifically, I'll just say it like that. What would your wife crave hearing from you about something that she has done recently, and make it specific? And principle number 10 is cheer for each other publicly. A compliment in private is nice. Sometimes a compliment in public is very rewarding. To have your significant other say something nice about you in the presence of other people can be a very affirming thing. I'm sorry I took too long. There was just a lot here, but hopefully some of it was...